She'd been on such a bad bass binge all that pregnant year. But so eventually the eight ball was consumed, and then the screen and steel wool ball in the pipe itself smoked, and the cloth prep filter smoked to ash, and then, of course, likely looking pieces of lint had been gleaned off the rug and also smoked. And the girl finally passed out, still umbilically linked to the dead infant. And how when she came to again in unsparing noonlight the next day and saw what still clung by a withered cord to her empty insides, she got introduced to the real business end of the arrow of responsibility. And as she gazed in daylight at the withered, faceless, stillborn baby, she was so overcome with grief and self-loathing that she erected a fortification of complete and black denial, like total denial. She held and swaddled the dead thing just as if it were alive instead of dead, and she began to carry it around with her wherever she went, just as she imagined devoted mothers carry their babies with them everywhere they go, the faceless infant's corpse, completely veiled and hidden in a little pink blanket the addicted expectant mother'd let herself buy at Woolworth's at 7 months. And she also kept the cord's connection intact until her end of the cord finally fell out of her and dangled and smelled. And she carried the dead infant everywhere, even when turning sordid tricks. Because single motherhood or not, she still needed to get high and still had to do what she had to do to get high. So she carried the blanket-wrapped infant in her arms as she walked the streets in her velvet fuchsia mini-pants and halter top and green spike heels turning tricks, until there began to be strong evidence, as she circled her block, it was August. Let's just say compelling evidence that the infant in the stained cocoon of blanket in her arms was not a biologically viable infant. And passers-by on the South Boston streets began to reel away, white-faced, as the girl passed by,
stretch-marked and brown-toothed and lashless.
Lashes lost in a substance accident, fire hazard and dental dysplasia go with the freebase terrain. And also just hauntedly calm-looking, oblivious to the olfactory havoc she was wreaking in the sweltering streets. But her August's trick business soon fell off sharply, understandably. And eventually word that there was a serious infant and denial problem here got around the streets. And her fellow Southie baseheads and street friends came to her with not ungentle R-less remonstrances and scented hankies and gently prying hands and tried to reason her out of her denial. But she ignored them all. She guarded her infant from all harm and kept it clutched to her. It was by now sort of stuck to her, and would have been hard to separate from her by hand anyway. And she'd walk the streets, shunned and trickless and broke, and in early stage substance withdrawal, with the remains of the dead infant's tummy's cord dangling out from an unclosable fold in the now ominously ballooned and crusty Woolworth's blanket. Talk about denial. This girl was in some major league denial.
But finally a pale and reeling beat cop phoned an hysterical olfactory alert in to the Commonwealth's infamous Department of Social Services.
Gately sees alcoholic moms all over the hall cross themselves and shudder at the mere mention of DSS. Every addicted parent's worst nightmare, DSS. They of the several different abstruse legal definitions of neglect and the tungsten-tipped battering ram for triple-locked apartment doors. In a dark window, Gately sees one reflected mom sitting over with the Brighton AAs that has her two little girls with her in the meeting, and now at the DSS reference, clutches them reflexively to her bosom, one head per bosom, as one of the girls struggles and dips her knees in the little curtsies of impending potty. But so now DSS was on the case, and a platoon of blandly efficient, Wellesley alum DSS field personnel with clipboards and scary black Chanel women's business wear were now on the prowl in the South Boston streets for the addicted speaker and her late faceless infant. But finally, around this time, during the last year's awful late August heat wave, evidence that the infant had a serious bioviability problem started presenting itself so forcefully that even the denial-ridden addict in the mother could not ignore or dismiss it. evidence which the speaker's reticence about describing, save to say that it involved an insect attraction problem, makes things all the worse for the empathetic white flaggers, since it engages the dark imaginations all substance abusers share in surplus. And so, but the mother says how she finally broke down, emotionally and olfactorily, from the overwhelming evidence on the cement playground outside her own late mother's abandoned project building off the L Street Beach in Southie. And a DSS field team closed in for the pinch, and she and her infant got pinched. And special DSS spray solvents had to be sent for and utilized in order to detach the Woolworth baby blanket from her maternal bosom. And the blanket's contents were more or less reassembled and were interred in a DSS coffin the speaker recalls as being the size of a Mary Kay makeup case. And the speaker was medically informed by somebody with a clipboard from DSS that the infant had been involuntarily toxified to death somewhere along in its development toward becoming a boy. And the mother, after a painful D&C for the impacted placenta she'd carried inside, then spent the next 4 months on the locked ward of Metropolitan State Hospital in Waltham, Massachusetts, psychotic with denial, deferred guilt, and cocaine withdrawal, and searing self-hatred. And how, when she finally got discharged from Met State with her first SSI mental disability check, she found she had no taste for chunks or powders. She wanted only tall, smooth bottles whose labels spoke of proof. And she drank and drank and believed in her heart she would never stop or swallow the truth. But finally she got to where she had to, she says, swallow it, the responsible truth. How she quickly drank her way to the old two-option welfare hotel window ledge and made a blubbering 0200 hours phone call. And then so, here she is, apologizing for going on so long, trying to tell a truth she hopes someday to swallow inside, so she can just try and live. When she concludes by asking them to pray for her, it almost doesn't sound corny. Gately tries not to think. Here is no cause or excuse. It is simply what happened. This final speaker is truly new, ready. All defenses have been burned away. Smooth-skinned and steadily pinker at the podium. Her eyes squeezed tight, she looks like she's the one that's the infant. The host white flaggers pay this burnt public husk of a newcomer the ultimate Boston AA compliment. They have to consciously try to remember even to blink as they watch her, listening, IDing without effort. There's no judgment. It's clear she's been punished enough. And it was basically the same all over, after all, out there. And the fact that it was so good to hear her, so good that even Tiny Ewell and Kate Gompert and the rest of the worst of them all sat still and listened without blinking, looking not just at the speaker's face but into it, helps force Gately to remember all over again what a tragic adventure this is that none of them signed up for. They'd been the odd couple of libations, the muscled fitness guru and the tall, slope-shouldered optician director, often down there in the weight room till all hours, sitting on the towel dispenser, drinking. Lyle with his caffeine-free Diet Coke, in Condenza with his wild turkey. Mario literally standing by in case the ice bucket ran out, or himself needed moral support getting to the urinal. Mario often fell asleep as the hour got severe, drifted in and out, slept upright and leaning forward, weight borne by his police lock and lead receptacle.
James Incandenza was one of those profound personality change drinkers who seemed quiet and centered and almost affectless when he was sober, but would move way out to one side or the other of the human emotional spectrum when drunk and seem to open up in a way that was almost injudicious.
Sometimes, libated late at night with Lyle in the newly outfitted ETA weight room, Incandenza'd open up and pour his heart's thickest chyme right out there for all to be affected and potentially scarred by. For example, One night, Mario, leaning way forward in the police lock support, drifted awake to the sound of his father saying that if he had to grade his marriage, he'd give it a C-. This seems injudicious in the extreme, potentially, though Mario, like Lyle, tends to take data pretty much as it comes. Lyle, who sometimes would start to get tipsy himself, as himself's pores began to excrete the bourbon, often brought some Blake out, as in William Blake, during these all-night sessions, and read in cadenza Blake, but in the voices of various cartoon characters, which himself eventually started regarding as deep.
146.
The 8th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment.
Gaudiamus igitur.
If it's odd that Mario Incandenza's first halfway coherent film cartridge, a 48-minute job shot three summers back in the carefully decorated janitor closet of subdorm B with his head mount Bolex H64 and foot treadle. If it's odd that Mario's first finished entertainment consists of a film of a puppet show, like a kid's puppet show, then it probably seems even odder that the film's proven to be way more popular with ETA's adults and adolescents than it is with the woefully, historically, underinformed children it had first been made for. It's proved so popular that it gets shown annually now every 11/8, Continental Interdependence Day, on a wide-beam cartridge projector and stand-up screen in the ETA dining hall after supper. It's part of the gala, but rather ironic, annual celebration of Interdependence Day at an academy whose founder had married a Canadian, and it usually gets underway about 19:30 hours, the film, and everybody gathers in the dining hall and watches it. And by Charles Tavis's festive fiat,
147.
Everybody gets to two-handed snack instead of squeezing tennis balls while they watch. And not only that, but normal ETA dietary regulations are, for an hour, completely suspended. And Mrs. Clark, the dietitian out in the kitchen, a former four-star dessert chef normally relegated here to protein conveyors and ways to very complex carbs, Mrs. Clark gets to put on her floppy white chef's hat and just go socratically mad out in Westhouse's gleaming kitchen. Everybody's supposed to wear some sort of hat. Avril Incandenza positively towers in the same steeple-crowned witch's hat she teaches all her classes in every 10:31. And Pemulus wears the complex yachting cap and naval braid. And Pale and Blotchy Struck a toque with a kind of flitty aigrette. And Hal a black preacher's hat with a stern, round, downturned brim, etc., etc.
148.
And Mario, as director and putative author of the popular film, is encouraged to say a few words, like, 8.
Thanks, everybody, and I hope you like it, is what he said this year,
with Pemulus behind him making a show of putting a maraschino on top of the small twizzle of Ready Whip that O. Stice had sprayed on the top of Mario's head-mounted Bolex H64, which counts as a hat, when the dessert course's zenith had gotten slightly out of control near the Interdependence Day gala supper's end. These few brief words and round of applause are Mario's big public yearly moment at ETA, and he neither likes the moment nor dislikes it. Same with the untitled film itself, which really started out as just a kid's adaptation of the O.N.A.N. Tired,
a four-hour piece of tendentiously anti-confluential political parody,
long since dismissed as minor incandenza by his late father's archivists. Mario's piece isn't really better than his father's. It's just different. Plus, of course, way shorter. It's pretty obvious that somebody else in the incandenza family had at least an Emmanuenic hand in the screenplay. But Mario did the choreography and most of the puppet work personally. His little S-shaped arms and falcate digits are perfect for the forward curve from body to snout of a standard big-headed political puppet. And it was, without question, Mario's little square hush puppy on the H-64's operant foot treadle, the Bolex itself mounted on one of the tunnel's locked labs, Husky 6TL tripods, across the overlit closet. Mops and dull gray janitorial buckets carefully moved out past the frame's borders on either side of the little velvet stage. Anne Kittenplan and two older crew-cut girls sit in identical snap-brim fedoras with their arms crossed.
Kittenplan's right hand bandaged.
Mary Esther Thode is grading midterms on the sly. Rick Dunkel has his eyes closed but is not asleep. Somebody slapped an ad hoc Red Sox cap on the visiting Sirian Satellite Pro, and the Sirian Satellite Pro sits with most of the prorectors, looking confused, his shoulder taped up with a heatable compress, being polite about the comparative authenticity of Mrs. C's baklava. Everyone gathers and all's quiet except for the sounds of saliva and chewing, and there's the yeasty sweet smell of Coach Stitt's pipe, and ETA's youngest kid, Tina Echt, in her giant beret, gets to be in charge of the lights. Mario's thing opens without credits, just a crudely matted imposition of fake linotype print, a quotation from President Gentle's second inaugural. Let the call go forth to pretty much any nation we might feel like calling, that the past has been torched by a new and millennial generation of Americans. Against a full facial still photo of a truly unmistakable personage. This is the projected face of Johnny Gentle, famous crooner. This is Johnny Gentle, formerly Joyner, lounge singer turned teeny bopper throb turned B-movie mainstay, for two long past decades known unkindly as the cleanest man in entertainment. The man's a world-class retentive, the late Howard Hughes kind. The really severe kind, the kind with the paralyzing fear of free-floating contamination. The either wear a surgical microfiltration mask or make the people around you wear surgical caps and masks and touch doorknobs only with a boiled hanky and take 14 showers a day, only they're not exactly showers. They're with this Dermalatex brand shower-sized hypospectral flash booth that actually like burns your outermost layer of skin off in a dazzling flash and leaves you baby's butt new and sterile.
Once you wipe off the coating of fine epidermal lash with a boiled hanky kind.
Then in later public life, a sterile toupee-wearing promoter, an entertainment union bigwig, Vegas schmaltz broker, and head of the infamous Velvety Vocalists Guild, the tanned, gold-chained labor union that enforced those 7 months of infamously dreadful live silence.
149.
The total scab-free solidarity and performative silence that struck floor shows and sound stages from desert to New Jersey coast for over half a year until equitable compensation formulae on certain late millennial phone order retrospective TV advertised so you don't forget order before midnight tonight type records and CDs were agreed on by management. Hence, then, Johnny Gentle, the man who brought GERCA to heel. And then thus, at the millennial fulcrum of very dark U.S. times, to national politics. The facial stills that Mario lap dissolves between are of Johnny Gentle, famous crooner, founding standard-bearer of the seminal new Clean U.S. Party, the strange-seeming but politically prescient annular agnation of ultra-right jingoist hunt deer with automatic weapons types, and far-left macrobiotic save the ozone rainforests whales, spotted owl and high pH waterways, ponytailed granola crunchers. A surreal union of both Rush Limbaugh and Hillary Rodham Clinton, disillusioned fringes that drew mainstream media guffaws at their first convention, held in sterile venue. The seemingly lauriciously marginal party whose first platform's plank had been, let's shoot our wastes into space.
150.
The Clean U.S. Party, known as CUSP, a kind of post-Perot national joke for 3 years, until white-gloved finger on the pulse of an increasingly asthmatic and sunscreen-slathered and pissed-off American electorate, the CUSP suddenly swept to quadrennial victory in an angry, reactionary voter spasm that made the UWSA and LaRouchers and libertarians chew their hands in envy as the Dems and GOPs stood on either side watching dumbly, like doubles partners who each think the others surely got it. The two established mainstream parties split open along tired philosophical lines in a dark time when all landfills got full and all grapes were raisins, and sometimes, in some places, the falling rain clunked instead of splatted, and also, recall, a post-Soviet and jihad era when, somehow even worse, there was no real foreign menace of any real unified potency to hate and fear. And the U.S. sort of turned in on itself in its own philosophical fatigue and hideous redolent wastes with a spasm of panicked rage that in retrospect seems possible only in a time of geopolitical supremacy and consequent silence, the loss of any external menace to hate and fear. This motionless face on the ETA screen is Johnny Gentle, third-party stunner. Johnny Gentle, the first U.S. president ever to swing his microphone around by the cord during his inauguration speech, whose new white-suited Office of Unspecified Services retinue required inauguration attendees to scrub and mask and then walk through chlorinated footbaths as at public pools. Johnny Gentle, managing somehow to look presidential in a Fukuyama microfiltration mask, whose inaugural address heralded the advent of a tighter, tidier nation, who promised to clean up government and trim fat and sweep out waste and hose down our chemically troubled streets and to sleep darn little until he'd fashioned a way to rid the American psychosphere of the unpleasant debris of a throwaway past, to restore the majestic ambers and purple fruits of a culture he now promises to rid of the toxic effluvia choking our highways and littering our byways and grunging up our sunsets and cruddying those harbors in which televised garbage barges lay stacked up at anchor, clotted and impotent amid undulating clouds of pot-bellied gulls and those disgusting blue-bodied flies that live on shit. First U.S. president ever to say shit publicly, shuddering. Rusty-hulled barges cruising up and down petroleated coastlines are laying up, reeking and stacked and emitting CO as they await the opening of new landfills and toxic repositories the people demanded in every area but their own. The Johnny Gentle whose cusp had been totally upfront about seeing American renewal as an essentially aesthetic affair. The Johnny Gentle who promised to be the possibly sometimes unpopular architect of a more or less spotless America that cleaned up its own side of the street. Of a new arid nation that looked out for Uno. Of a one-time world policeman that was now going to retire and have its blue uniform deep dry-cleaned and placed in storage in triple-thick plastic dry-cleaning bags and hang up its cuffs to spend some quality domestic time raking its lawn and cleaning behind its refrigerator and dandling its freshly bathed kids on its neatly pressed, mufti pants knee. A Gentle behind whom a diorama of the Lincoln Memorial's Lincoln smiled down benignly. A Johnny Gentle who was, as of this new minute, sending forth the call that he wasn't in this for a popularity contest.
Popsicle stick and felt puppets in the address's audience, assuming puzzled-looking expressions above their tiny green surgical masks.
A President Johnny Gentle, F.C., who said he wasn't going to stand here and ask us to make some tough choices, because he was standing here promising he was going to make them for us, who asked us simply to sit back and enjoy the show, who handled wild applause from camouflage, fatigue, and sandal and poncho-clad cusps with the unabashed grace of a real pro, who had black hair and silver sideburns, just like his big-headed puppet, and the dusty brick-colored tan seen only among those without homes, and those whose homes had a dermalatex hypospectral personal sterilization booth, who declared that neither tax and spend nor cut and borrow comprised the ticket into a whole new millennial era. Here more puzzlement among the inaugural audience, which Mario represents by having the tiny-fingered puppets turn rigidly toward each other, and then away, and then toward. Who alluded to ripe and available novel sources of revenue just waiting out there, unexploited, not seen by his predecessors because of the trees? Who foresaw budgetary adipose, trimmed with a really big knife? The Johnny Gentle who stressed above all, simultaneously pleaded for and promised, an end to atomized Americans' fractious blaming of one another for our terrible internal troubles.
151.
Here, bobs and smiles from both wealthily green-masked puppets and homeless puppets in rags and mismatched shoes and with used surgical masks, all made by ETA's fourth and fifth grade crafts class under the supervision of Ms. Heath, of matchsticks and popsicle stick shards and pool table felt with sequins for eyes and painted fingernail pairings for smiles or frowns under their masks. The Johnny Gentle, chief executive who pounds a rubber-gloved fist on the podium so hard it knocks the seal askew and declares that, damn it, there must be some people besides each other of us to blame, to unite in opposition to. And he promises to eat light and sleep very little until he finds them, in the Ukraine, or the Teutons, or the wacko Latins, or, pausing with that one arm up, and head down in the climactic Vegas way, closer to right below our noses. He swears he'll find us some cohesion-renewing other, and then make some tough choices. Alludes to a whole new North America for a crazy post-millennial world. First U.S. president ever to use boss as an adjective. His throwing the surgical gloves into the miniature inaugural crowd as souvenirs is Mario's own touch. And Mario Incandenza's idea of representing President Gentle's cabinet is made up mostly of tall, coiffured black girl puppets and shiny imbricate sequin dresses is also, of course, historically inaccurate, though the honorary inclusion in that cabinet's second year of the Presidente of Mexico and the Prime Minister of Canada is both factual and, of course, seminal. The President of Mexico and Prime Minister of Canada, in unison and green mask muffled.
It is tremendously flattering to be invited to sit on the cabinet of the leadership of our beloved neighbor to the...
Choose one. Gentle.
Thanks, boys. You have gorgeous souls.
It's not the cartridge's strongest scene, heavy on stock phrases and two-handed handshakes. But the historical fact that the Presidente of Mexico and Prime Minister of Canada are honorarily appointed by President Gentle to be secretaries of Mexico and Canada, respectively, as if the neighbors had already become sort of post-millennial American protectorates, is foreshadowed as ominous by a wavering D minor on the soundtrack's organ. Mrs. Clark's Wurlitzer at home. But the two leaders' respectively dusky and Gallic expressions seem unperturbed under their green masks as more stock phrases are invoked. Because budget and broom closet constraints make artful transitions between scenes impractical, Mario has opted for the inter-scenic entre-act device of having Johnny Gentle, famous crooner, doing some of his repertoire's bouncier numbers, with the cabinet members undulating and harmonizing Motownishly behind him, and other puppets bouncing in tempo on and off stage as the script requires. Audience-wise, most of the ETA's under 12, Cortex's spangling with once-a-year sweets, have by now emigrated hyperactively under the long table's tablecloths and met up on the dining hall floor below, and begun navigating on hands and knees the special children's second world of shins and chair legs and tile that exists under long tablecloths, making various sorts of puerile trouble. Investigations from last year's Interdependence Day are still in progress, wrought which kid or kids tied Aubrey Dillon's shoelaces together and crazy glued Mary Esther Thode's left buttock to the seat of her chair. But everyone glycemically mature enough to sit still and watch the cartridge is having a rousing good time, eating chocolate cannolis and 26-layer baklava, and Ready Whip by itself if they want, and homemade raisinettes, and little cream-filled caramel things, and occasionally heckling or cheering ironically. Every so often throwing sweets that stick to the screen, giving the smooth, sterile, gentle, a sort of carbuncular look that everyone approves. There is much cracking wise and baritone mimicry of a president roundly disliked for over 2 terms now. Only John Wayne and a handful of other Canadian students sit, unhatted, chewing stolidly, faces blurred and distant. This American penchant for absolution via irony is foreign to them. The Canadian boys remember only hard facts, and the glass-walled Great Convexity, whose southern array of ATH-SCME effectuators blow the tidy U.S.'s northern oxides north toward home. And they feel with special poignancy, on 11-8, the implications of their being down here, south of the border, training, in the land of their enemy ally. And the less gifted among them wonder whether they'll ever get to go home again after graduation, if a pro career or scholarship doesn't pan out. Wayne has a cloth hanky and keeps wiping his nose. Mario's openly jejune version of his late father's take on the rise of ONAN and U.S. imperialism unfolds in little diffracted bits of real news and fake news and privately conceived dialogue between the architects and hard choice makers of a new millennial era. Gentle.
Another piece of pre-tasted cobbler, JJJC?
Prime Minister of Canada.
Couldn't. Stuffed.
Having trouble breathing. I would not say no to another beer, however. Gentle. Prime Minister of Canada. Gentle.
So we're simpatico on the gradual and subtle but inexorable disarmament and dissolution of NATO as a system of mutual defense agreements.
Prime Minister of Canada. Less muffled than last seen because his surgical mask gets to have a prandial hole. We are side by side and behind you on this thing. Let the EEC pay for their own defendings, henceforth, I say. Let them foot some defensive budgets and then try to subsidize their farmers into undercutting NAFTA. Let them eat butter and guns for their own for once in a change, eh?
Gentle. You said more than a mouthful right there, JJ. Now maybe we can all direct some cool-headed attention to our own infraternal affairs. Our own internal quality of life. Refocusing priorities back to this crazy continent we call home. Am I being Doug?
Prime Minister of Canada. John, I am kilometers ahead of you. I happen to have my term in office at a glance book right here with me. Now that the big frap of yours are being put down, we are wondering, what is the date I can be penciling in for the removals of NATO ICBM frappures from Manitoba?
Gentle. Put that pencil away, you good-looking Canadian. I've got more long, shiny trailer rigs full of large men with very short haircuts and white suits than you can shake a maple leaf at, heading for your silos right this very. Those complete totalities of Canada's strategic capacity will be out of your hair toot sweet.
Prime Minister of Canada. John, let me be the first world leader to call you a statesman.
Gentle. We North Americans have to stick together, JJJC, especially now, no? Am I off base? We're interdependent. We're cheek to jowl.
Prime Minister of Canada. It is a smaller world today.
Gentle. And an even smaller continent.
This segues into an entr'acte, with continent squeezed in for world in It's a Small World After All, which in jammed doesn't do the rhythm section of doo-wopping cabinet girls a bit of good, but does usher in the start of a whole new era. Though can any guru be held to a standard of like 100% exemption from the human pains of stunted desire? No. Not 100%, regardless of level of transcendence or diet. Lyle, down in the dark, interdependent stay weight room, sometimes recalls an ETA player from several years back, whose first name was Marlon, and his last name Lyle never, to his knowledge, learned.
152.
The thing about this Marlin was that he was always wet. Arms purling, t-shirt darkly V'd, face and forehead ever gleaming. Oren's Academy doubles partner. It had had a lemony, locale taste, the boy's omni-wetness. It wasn't exactly sweat because you could lick off the forehead and more beads instantly replaced what you'd taken. None of real sweat's frustratingly gradual accretion. The boy was always in the shower, always doing his best to stay clean. There were powders and pills and electrical appliques. And still this Marlin dripped and shone. The kid wrote accomplished juvenile verses about the dry, clean boy inside, struggling to break the soggy surface. He shared extensively with Lyle. He confessed to Lyle one night in the quiet weight room that he'd gone in for high-level athletics mostly to have an excuse of some sort for being as wet as he was. It always looked like Marlin had been rained on. But it wasn't rain. It's like Marlin hadn't been dry since the womb. It's like he leaked. It had been a tormenting but also in certain ways halcyon few years in the past. A tormentingly unspecific hope in the air. Lyle had told this boy everything he had to tell. It's raining tonight, though. As so often happens in autumn below the great concavity, PM snow has given way to rain. Outside the weight room's high windows, a mean wind sweeps curtains of rain this way and that, and the windows shudder and drool. The sky is a mess. Thunder and lightning happen at the same time. The copper beach outside creaks and groans. Lightning claws the sky, briefly illuminating Lyle, seated, Lotus, in spandex on the towel dispenser, leaning forward to accept what is offered in the dark weight room. The idle resistance machines look insectile in the lightning's brief light. The answer to some of the newer kids' complaints about what on earth Lyle can be doing down there at night in a locked, empty weight room is that the nighttime weight room is rarely empty. The PM custodians, Kenkel and Brandt, do lock it up, but the door can be dickied by even the clumsiest insertion of an ETA meal card between latch and jamb. The kitchen crew always wonders why so many meal cards' edges always look ravaged. Though the idle machines are scary and the room smells somehow worse in the dark, they come most at night, the ETAs, who are on to Lyle. They hit the saunas out by the cement stairs until they've got enough incentive on their skin. Then they lurk, pearled and shiny, in towels by the weight room door, waiting to enter one by one. Sometimes several ETAs dripping in towels, not speaking, some pretending to have other business down there, lurking in the eye-averted attitudes of, like, patients in the waiting room of an impotence clinic, or shrink. They have to be real quiet, and the lights stay off. It's like the administration will turn a blind eye as long as you make it plausible to do so. From the dining hall, whose east wall of windows faces calm ad, you can hear very muffled laughter and kibitzing and the occasional scream from Mario's interdependent puppet thing. A quiet, slow, small stream of yellow, slickered, wet-shoed migrations back and forth between West House and the weight room. People know the slow parts, the times to duck out and go very briefly down to Lyle to confer. They dicky the lock and go in one by one in towels, proffer beaded flesh, confront the sort of issues reserved for nighttime's garudical tete-a-tete, whispers made echoless by rubberized floors and much damp laundry. Sometimes Lyle will listen and shrug and smile and say, "The world is very old," or some such general remark, and decline to say much else. But it's the way he listens, somehow, that keeps the saunas full. Lightning claws the eastern sky, and it's neat in the weight room's dark because Lyle is in a slightly different position and forward angle each time he's illuminated through the window up over the grip-slash-wrist-slash-forearm machines to his left. So it looks like there are different Lyles at different fulgurant moments. Lamont Chu, glabrous and high gloss and a white towel and wristwatch, haltingly confesses to an increasingly crippling obsession with tennis fame. He wants to get to the show so bad it feels like it's eating him alive. To have his picture in shiny magazines, to be a wunderkind, to have guys in blue ISPN blazers describe his every on-court move and mood in hushed broadcast cliches, to have little patches with products' names sewn onto his clothes, to be soft-profiled, to get compared to Monsieur Chang, lately expired, to get called the next great yellow U.S. hope. Let's not even talk about video magazines or the grid. He confesses it to Lyle. He wants the hype. He wants it. Sometimes he'll pretend a glowing up-at-net action shot he's clipping out of a shiny magazine is of him, Lamont Chu. But then he finds he can't eat or sleep or sometimes even pee. So horribly does he envy the adults in the show who get to have up-at-net action shots of themselves in magazines. Sometimes, he says, lately, he won't take risks in tournament matches even when risks are okay or even called for because he finds he's too scared of losing and hurting his chances for the show and hype and fame down the road. A couple times this year, the cold, clenched fear of losing has itself made him lose, he believes. He's starting to fear that rabid ambition has more than one blade, maybe. He's ashamed of his secret hunger for hype in an academy that regards hype and the seduction of hype as the great Mephistophelian pitfall and hazard of talent. A lot of these are his own terms. He feels himself in a dark world inside, ashamed, lost, locked in. Lamont Chu is 11 and hits with two hands off both sides. He doesn't mention the eschaton or having been punched in the stomach. The obsession with future tense fame makes all else pale. His wrists are so thin he wears his watch halfway up his forearm, which looks sort of gladiatorial. Lyle has a way of sucking on the insides of his cheeks as he listens. Plates of old, rigid muscle emerge and subside as he shifts his weight slightly on the raised towel dispenser. The dispenser is at about shoulder height for someone like Chu. Like all good listeners, he has a way of attending that is at once intense and assuasive. The supplicant feels both nakedly revealed and sheltered somehow from all possible judgment. It's like he's working as hard as you. You both of you, briefly, feel unalone. Lyle will suck in first one side's cheek and then the other.
You burn to have your photograph in a magazine.
I'm afraid so.
Why again exactly now?
I guess to be felt about as I feel about those players with their pictures in magazines.
Why?
Why? I guess to give my life some sort of kind of meaning, Lyle.
And how would this do this again?
Lyle, I don't know. I don't know. It just does. It would. Why else would I burn like this? Clip secret pictures, not take risks, not sleep or pee.
You feel these men with their photographs in magazines care deeply about having their photographs in magazines derive immense meaning?
I do. They must. I would. Else why would I burn like this to feel as they feel?
The meaning they feel, you mean, from the fame.
Lyle, don't they?
Lyle sucks his cheeks. It's not like he's condescending or stringing you along. He's thinking as hard as you. It's like he's you in the top of a clean pond. It's part of the attention. One side of his cheeks almost caves in, thinking.
Lamont. Perhaps they did at first. The first photograph, the first magazine, the gratified surge. the seeing themselves as others see them, the hagiography of image, perhaps. Perhaps the first time, enjoyment. After that, do you trust me? Trust me. They do not feel what you burn for. After the first surge, they care only that their photographs seem awkward or unflattering or untrue, or that their privacy, this thing you burn to escape, what they call their privacy, is being violated. Something changes. After the first photograph has been in a magazine, the famous men do not enjoy their photographs in magazines so much as they fear that their photographs will cease to appear in magazines. They are trapped, just as you are.
Is this supposed to be good news? This is awful news.
Lamont, are you willing to listen to a remark about what is true?
Okie dokie.
The truth will set you free, but not until it is finished with you.
Maybe I ought to be getting back.
Lamont, the world is very old. You have been snared by something untrue. You are deluded. But this is good news. You have been snared by the delusion that envy has a reciprocal. You assume that there is a flip side to your painful envy of Michael Chang, namely, Michael Chang's enjoyable feeling of being envied by Lamont Chu. No such animal.
Animal?
You burn with hunger for food that does not exist.
This is good news.
It is the truth. To be envied, admired, is not a feeling, nor is fame a feeling. There are feelings associated with fame, but few of them are any more enjoyable than the feelings associated with envy of fame.
The burning doesn't go away?
What fire dies when you feed it? It is not fame itself they wish to deny you here. Trust them. There is much fear in fame. Terrible and heavy fear to be pulled and held, carried. Perhaps they want only to keep it off you until you weigh enough to pull it toward yourself.
Would I sound ungrateful if I said this doesn't make me feel very much better at all?
Lamont, the truth is that the world is incredibly, incredibly, unbelievably old. You suffer with the stunted desire caused by one of its oldest lies. Do not believe the photographs. Fame is not the exit from any cage.
So I'm stuck in the cage from either side. Fame or tortured envy of fame. There's no way out.
You might consider how escape from a cage must surely require,
foremost, awareness of the fact of the cage. And I believe I see a drop on your temple right there.
Etc. The thunders died down to a mutter, and the windows, spatters gone random, and post-storm sad. An ETA female students wear two different towels coming in. A breastless senior who can barely perspire at all is troubled whenever she has lunch with her fiancé, by the persistent whine of a mosquito that she can't see and no one else can hear. Summer and winter, indoors or al fresco, but only at lunch and only with her fiancé. Remarks or advice are not always the point. Sometimes suffering's point is almost crying out in a high-pitched whine to be heard. As fitness gurus go, Lyle is results-oriented and can do.
153.
10-year-old Kent Blott, whose parents are Seventh-day Adventists, isn't yet old enough to masturbate, but he hears quite a lot about it, not surprisingly, from his adolescent peers, in rather lush detail, masturbation, and is worried about what sorts of homemade-type potentially wicked and soul-sapping pornographic cartridges will run through his psychic projector as he masturbates, when he eventually can masturbate, and worries about whether different sorts of fantasy scenes and combinations herald different sorts of psychic dysfunction or turpitude, and wants to get a good jump on worrying about it. The sounds of the dining hall's gala are more frequent and convulsive without the sound of rain. Lyle tells Blot not to let the weight he would pull to himself exceed his own personal weight. Up to the left, the storm's clouds, stragglers, run like ink and water between the window and the risen moon. Mario Incandenza's presidential puppet is just about to inaugurate subsidized time. 16B's Anton Duchette's been driven to Lyle, he says, by an increasing self-consciousness about the big, round, dark, raised mole on his upper lip, just under his left nostril. It's only a mole, but looks pretty dire, nasally. People who first meet him are always pulling him off to the side and handing him a Kleenex. Duchette lately wishes either the mole were gone or he were gone. Even if people don't stare at the mole, it's like they're intentionally not staring at it. Duchette pounds himself on the chest and thigh, supposedly in frustration. He just cannot come to terms with how it must look. It's getting worse as puberty intensifies, the anxiety. Then, in a vicious cycle, the anxiety prompts a nervous tic on his face's right side. He's starting to suspect that some upperclassmen are referring to him behind his back as Anton Booger Duchette. It's like he's frozen on this anxiety, unable to move on to more advanced anxieties. He can't see any way past this. The pounding is more a sign of intense, unconscious self-hatred, though, Lyle knows. Duchette grimaces and says he's starting to want to play tennis with his hand over his nose and upper lip. But he has a two-handed backhand, and it's too late to switch, and there's no way they're going to let him switch to one hand just for aesthetic reasons. Lyle sends Anton Duchette packing off with directions to come back with Mario Incandenza the minute the Interdependence Day gala lets out. Mario gets a fair number of aesthetic self-consciousness referrals from Lyle. No type or rank of guru is above delegating. It's like a law. Duchette says it's like he's stuck. It's becoming all he thinks about. This on his way out. His back's additional moles form no outline or shape. Lyle pops the tab to a caffeine-free Diet Coke Mario tends to bring down most evenings around supper time. In between door dickyings and visits, Lyle does little isometric neck stretches for the tension. Between Gerhard Stitt's pipe and Avril Incandenza's Benson and Hedges, and certain cheeks full of chewing tobacco, plus the maddening cooking smells of honey and chocolate and real high-lipid walnuts from the kitchen vents, plus over 150 very fit bodies, only some of which have been showered on this day off, the dining hall is warm and close and multi-odored. Mario, as auteur, opts for his late father's parodic device of mixing real and fake news summary cartridges, magazine articles, and historical headers from the last few great daily papers, all for a sort of time-lapse exposition of certain developments leading up to interdependence and subsidized time, and cartographic reconfiguration, and the renewal of a tight and considerably tidier experialist U.S. of A. under Gentle. Ukraine, two more Baltic states apply for NATO inclusion. 16-point bold header. So then, why a NATO? Editorial header. EEC sides with Pacific Rim, ups tariffs in response to U.S. quotas. Header. Gentle on waste storage from dismantled NATO therms. Not in my nation, babe. 12-point subheader. Amid smiles and two-handed handshakes that belied the high tension here, the leaders of 12 out of 15 NATO nations today signed an accord effectively dismantling the Western Bloc's 55-year-old defensive alliance. New summary cartridge voiceover. U.S.-Canadian support cuts doomed NATO summit from start, Icelandic poll declares.
Header.
So then why not a continental alliance now, maybe?
Editorial header.
Mexico signs on for Organization of North American Nations, Continental Alliance, but Quebec separatists rally against Finlandization of ONAN Alliance. But, gentle to Canada, unless ONAN treaty signed, NAFTA null. Manitoban therm stay put. Intracontinental pollution and waste disposal each nation's interests to pursue to the best they see fit.
Header from veteran but methamphetamine-dependent headliner, finally demoted after repeated warnings about taking up too much space.
Fed workers protest random fingernail hygiene screens.
12-point header.
Gentle proposes nationalization of Interlace Telent.
Header.
Says government in line for piece of the action on video, cartridge, disc rentals.
8-point subheader.
Burger King's Pillsbury awarded rights to New Year.
Header.
Pizza Hut's PepsiCo files bid rigging complaint with IRS.
12-point subheader.
Calendar and pre-printed check industries stocks soar.
8-point subheader. Three blue-jawed convicts in antiquated stripes dicky their cells lock and run. Backed by sirens and searchlights, crisscrossed play. Not for the wall, but straight to the warden's empty nighttime office, where they sit, wrapped before his old dual-modem Macintosh, slapping their knees and pointing to the monitor and elbowing each other in the ribs, nibbling at inexplicably appeared boxes of popcorn, with a voiceover.
Cartridges by modem. Just insert a blank diskette. Break free of the confinement of your channel selector.
Some more of Ms. Heath's classes puppets in a B-film parody of the interlaced tell entertainment ads that the cable networks seem so mysteriously, suicidally, to run all the time that last year of unsubsidized time.
ONAN Pact penned.
24-point superheader.
Canada knuckles under.
Tabloidish New York Daily's 24-point superheader.
Acid rain, landfills, barges, fusion tech. Manitoban therms were big sticks, Chrétien admits.
16-point header.
Short-haired men in shiny trucks are not dismantling Manitoban therms, but instead moving them just over border into Turtle Mountain Indian Reservation, horrified North Dakota governor charges.
12-point subheader from demoted headliner already in Dutch down in the subheader department. Now two.
Exclusive color photos show brave docs futilely fighting time to remove railroad spike from Canadian Prime Minister's right eye.
Tabloidish New York Daily's 16-point header.
President's office is a anally retentive horror show, says this just-retired White House custodian.
Tabloid header with photo of old guy with basically one eyebrow, running all the way across his forehead, holding up a mammoth plastic barrel he claims held just one day's haul of dental stimulators, alcohol-soaked cotton puffs, GI X-ray grade colonic purgative bottles, epidermal ash, surgical masks and gloves, Q-tips, Kleenex, and homeopathic pruritus cream containers.
USO U.S. Chief Tyne, charges of an Oval Office littered with Kleenex and floss, a clear case of dirty tricks.
Respectable Daily Header.
Overloaded waste barges collide, capsize off Gloucester.
Boston Daily Header.
Huge putrid slick empties beaches off both shores, Cape.
Equally large subheader.
Gentle speaks out on a U.S. constipatedly impacted on continental waste at UNLV commencement.
Header.
Ad Council report. Boston's Viney and Veals agency's liposuction and tongue stick campaigns not to blame for ABC HQ bomb threats.
Advertising age header.
The governors of Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire today reacted strongly to President Gentle's establishment of a blue-ribbon panel of waste experts to investigate the feasibility of mass landfill and conversion sites in northern New England. Respectable New York Daily's lead graph.
We are not this continent.